This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for joining us on our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. You know those main streets in all those towns, there's typically somebody there who's been there a long time and can tell you, you know, some of the rich history of that particular place. A lot can change in a single lifetime. Inez Doctor grew up near Venturia, North Dakota, during the Depression and the 1940s. She's now in her 80s, and Inez wishes she knew more about the people who came before her. She doesn't want her children and grandchildren to yearn to know about her generation, so she did something about it. She wrote a book. Inez spoke with our Ashley Thornburg about the result, which is titled Prairie Girl Memoir.
Inez, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, I'm happy to be here, yes.
Why did you want to write this book?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. I grew up in a, I guess, I always call it like a closed community compared to maybe the way my children or grandchildren have grown up. And everybody knew each other, and we probably were all related in some way or another. And I've always thought it would be nice if my children, my grandchildren, my heirs would have more information about this, because they probably have been in that area, but it's totally changed. You could never imagine that's the same place as where I grew up.
Right. Well, as I'm sitting here paging through the book and I'm thinking about, boy, I have never had to haul water in my life, much less every single day, multiple times a day to make food or to get a bath ready. I've never needed to go out and grab a chicken and slaughter it. I've never given that much thought to where food comes from. And this is obviously within just a lifetime how much life changes. So, yes, not recognizable. I understand that.
I think of, like, say, my own children who are now in their 50s would have to put themselves in that place and try to survive. I'm sure they'd survive, but it wouldn't be very easy. It would be a learning curve.
Well, yeah. I think that's a really important reason for a book like this, is to remind people it wasn't so easy. We have this romantic notion all the time of what the past is like. We tend to romanticize what life was like and, you know, that pioneering homesteading spirit. But in your book, you talk about that your hours were incredibly long, arduous tasks. There was a lot of infant and child loss within your family and just at the time. Life was difficult. Your childhood, I would say, was difficult.
Yeah, looking back now, yes. And, you know, when I talk about it, my siblings and I talk about it, we all sort of have a different take on it, even though we lived in the same household. It's where we were in the birth order, more than likely. And then, you know, I've lived old enough that I can live now in all the women's movements. And here, men or girls and boys were treated very differently. And I'm sure it came from old European ideas and also, the time that we lived in, we were treated differently. Mm-hmm. Boys were expected to do certain things if you were a farm child, and girls were expected to do other things. Mm-hmm. But it almost always boiled down to work. that was it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's interesting to me that you say, you know, you're talking about living through the women's movement and especially growing up in a rural area in the time that you did. And one thing that we know about farmsteading is that men work very hard. One story that we don't hear as often is how hard the life was and how dedicated and hardworking that the women and the children are. Did you mean to do that when you wrote the book, to make this about the contributions of women and children?
Definitely. My mother was very verbal about a lot of those things, about, you know, how different it is for women than men. And so I think she instilled that in us. And this sort of, I don't mention it in the book. I don't believe I do. But when my parents sold their farm, when the bill of sale came out for the auction sale after 35 years, my mother's name was not on it. And she brought
she
that
toiled.
Up. She pardon, yes. She did the same, you know, she, like you say, she toiled. And, you know, it was just something that, you know, you would think like in the 60s would have changed, but it still had not changed. Mm. Yes.
I want to talk about a chapter in your book that's called Other Losses, and this follows up on a chapter of the loss of a dear friend of yours, Maxine, and then the next chapter is Other Losses, and it's about education. I didn't see that coming in a title like Other Losses. Walk us through your educational experiences as a farm girl in the 40s and 50s.
Okay. So when I talk about this with people my age now, it's like it's kind of jaw-dropping.
Mm-hmm.
but at the time when I was ready to be done with eighth grade, which was the rural school, went to eighth grade, the laws in North Dakota, because we're an agricultural, or we're, it was an agricultural state, were that you had to educate your children either eighth grade or 16. Well, at 16, age 16, that would mean that children just never got out of the eighth grade until they were 16. But we started school at 5. First grade. There was no kindergarten. So when I was done with eighth grade, which was, we had these school years that work to accommodate the farm kids. It was, I think, April, and I was 12. So, and then my birthday is in June. So from the time that I was 12 going on 13, I never was in a formal school because the families could decide not to send their children to high school. We were 8 miles from the nearest high school, and there was an expense involved because in the wintertime, a lot of times the kids had to board. So my parents made this choice not to educate, send me to high school and my older sister.
Mm-hmm. And your brother went.
And my brother went. And mm-hmm. I tell in the book that they decided to send him because they figured he could never be a farmer because he had hay fever very bad. Well, I was a girl, and I also had hay fever, but that didn't matter. So, you know, it was a loss. It was a big loss. And it's something that and later on my parents, especially my dad, they expressed regret mm-hmm. when they saw how difficult it was for me to have a good paying work. And, you know, it mm-hmm. was a struggle. Mm-hmm. I worked in factories. I eventually went back to school at 34 yeah. and earned my GED. And one of the instructors says, I've never had anybody in my class that never went to high school. They were all dropouts. And, of course, you know, I don't know how much of that I wrote, but I definitely, you know, I wrote it. It was part of a loss that happened, you know, mm-hmm. to me as a child growing up. We couldn't imagine now a 12 or 13-year-old not going to school.
Right.
We just couldn't imagine.
It is actually criminal.
That's right.
Yeah.
And even they changed the law. Like the sister next to me was 5 years younger. She went to high school because they changed the law.
We're visiting with Inez Doctor, the author of Prairie Girl Memoir, Growing Up on a Dakota Farm, whose family had deep roots in German immigrant grandparents' ideas and values. Inez, where did you, for a memoir, was this all memory? Did you refer back to journals? Did you compare stories with cousins, siblings?
A little of everything, but I started to journal when I was probably in my mid-40s. And so I had like 25 years of journaling.
Wow.
And when I decided to do this, I went back through all the journals, and there was really hardly nothing in there that fit to what I wanted to write about, because I was journaling about me as an adult, and I wanted to write about my childhood. So it was from memory, and then the chapter, the first five years, I did draw on a lot of memories from my older sister, who was 5 years older than I. And, you know, she told me things that some of them I remembered and some of them I didn't. But she had more detail than I did. And so I decided to write about them. And I worked on this for at least 5 years. And I had this big legal pad. And whenever I would think of something, I would jot it down. And then when I tried to put it into chapters, then I organized what I had jotted down. And while I was doing the writing, all this stuff popped up.
Mm.
And even since I finished the book, and I've done a couple of book signings, and I had questions from people that read it, friends, family, and then it jogged up something else that I didn't put in.
You said you wanted to write a book about your childhood, and it ends with you barely 18 and getting married, and then the reader is wondering about adulthood, and you have all these journals about adulthood. Will there be a second book?
No, there won't be a second book.
Well, that was very definitive. Why not?
When I read through these journals, I decided that it was not something I wanted to write about, that I didn't. And I've had people ask about the second book, and I said, no, there won't be another second book.
Well, get this one then while you can. It's called A Prairie Girl Memoir. Inez, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's wonderful to be here.
That was Inez Doctor, author of Prairie Girl Memoir, visiting with our Ashley Thornburg. Her book is available from Amazon and at the German-Russian Heritage Collection at the NDSU Library. Next on Main Street, a StoryCorps excerpt from a friend of Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Easter Seals Goodwill ND Inc., providing support for children, adults, and families in need across North Dakota, thanks to donated goods at their Goodwill retail stores. Learn more at esgwnd.org, because a better community starts with you.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Bill and Dina Butcher gave much to their adopted state of North Dakota and to Prairie Public as longtime friends and supporters. Dina served under Governors John Hoeven and Ed Schaefer and recently led the North Dakotans for Public Integrity to create an ethics commission for the state. Bill was a Navy man who later rose through the ranks of the FBI. Bill passed away Friday at age 79. In an excerpt from a visit to the StoryCorps mobile booth in July 2018, Bill talks with his daughter, Marnie Peel, about his love of sailing and other adventures, including working as an FBI agent in Minot in the 1960s.
Minot was the most famous red light district in the whole region. They used to say that no red-blooded American man could go on the train from Chicago to Seattle without stopping at least one night in Minot. In 1963, it's really an interesting thing, the Junior Chamber of Commerce, the JCs in Minot, published a booklet entitled Why Minot? And that's as opposed to the Why Not Minot theme that they use there. And what it does is it's in three sections. The first section shows the records, the arrest records, and the photographs of all the places on 3rd Street in Minot where the hookers worked, and named the pimps and the hookers and showed their arrest records.
Oh, my gosh.
The middle section are interviews with hookers talking about how much per trick and who they worked for and who they worked with.
In 1963.
Yeah. The last section are interviews with state officials from the governor on down, including the sheriff, I might add, who was interesting because he was shocked to find out that there was actually prostitution going on in his city. The hookers would or the prostitutes would arrive at the train depot that was down at the bottom of the hill downtown. Third Street was where all the houses of ill repute were located, and there was the only one thing in between them, and that was Stearns Motors, which is now I. Keating Furniture. And I have toured the tunnel where the hookers, and before that, during Prohibition, the booze, were transported underneath Stearns Motors. Train would arrive at night. They'd go up through the tunnel, go to Third Street. When they left, they went through the tunnel and got back on the train and got out of there. One of my favorite stories is Ray Dobson was the editor of the Minot Daily News, and he said a lot of the downtown businessmen used to go to Third Street for lunch. And so they'd go into the House of Ill Repute, sit in the kitchen, they'd play gin rummy, and they'd have a pot of soup on, and they'd eat soup. The federal government had a raid. It was right after that booklet was written. Judge Register is the only federal judge I've ever known that actually directed personally a raid from the street in front of where they were raiding. And Deputy Marshal Bill Clayson, who was well known in Bismarck and Minot, led the charge, so to speak. And so one of the businessmen was going back to work. He went out the front and he saw that there were federal officers all over. He says, it's a raid. The feds are out there. And so somebody else made a break for the back door. And he came back in and said, there's feds out and back, too. And so the editor of the Minot Daily News said, wait a minute, I'm with the news. I shouldn't be making the news. I'm supposed to report the news. That was back in the snap brim hat days. And he took a strip of where you keep score for gin rummy, turned it over, used the golf pencil that they kept score with, and in big block letters put press on it, put it in the snap brim hat under the band. And when the feds came in, he said, I'm from the news, and I got a tip.
I like your stories because they're like the stories that I tell to my children. Like, I believe them, but I believe that they're better because you tell them. So there's truth in there.
It's all in the telling.
It's all in the telling. And they make fun of me. My whole family makes fun of me. I say, I'm my father's daughter. We tell stories. That's what we do. Okay, so that's one way to find adventure in North Dakota is the early 60s in Minot. But I want to talk about Lake Sakakawea and what a treasure it is.
Well, I've sailed a lot of places all around the United States and in Europe. And I can honestly say that the Lake Sakakawea is the best sailing lake I've ever been on, and it's wonderful. 178 miles long, more shoreline than the state of California, bays everywhere, very few cottages, and it's wonderful. The water is really pure. The winds are steady. You can drink that water. It's wonderful to swim in. And the bays are spectacular. So we love to spend a weekend or sometimes 10 days just cruising on Lake Sakakawea. And it's so isolated. There's nothing there. It's just amazing. It's a paradise on earth.
It is. It really is. And it's because it's flooded in the Badlands. So all those gullies and valleys of Badlands are all these great, narrow, protected bays. Yeah. So you can ride out a storm, which you've ridden out plenty of storms.
I had a guy call me once as a private investigator, and he said, you may not remember me, but you ran aground on your sailboat up at Lake Sakakawea once, and I had my big powerboat up there, and he says, I helped pull you off. He says, do you remember that at all? And I said, you could be 1 in 100 people. We were out with a friend and his daughter. I never wear a life jacket on the boat. Had dinner with some friends at anchor on the other side of the lake, and we were headed back, and I knew there was a storm brewing up north, but I had no idea it was moving nearly as fast as it was, and we came back, and all of a sudden at about 7 o'clock at night, which is early in North Dakota, it turned pitch black, purple black, and the wind was over 100 miles an hour, and we were out there, and so we put up just a handkerchief of a head sail and just headed down the lake with the wind because there was really no alternative. I couldn't see the other shore and I couldn't see the bay. And so we just kept going and going and going. The wind was blowing so hard that the bow of the boat was just inches above the water, and the stern, a lot of times even going with the wind, the rudder at the stern was out of the water.
Oh.
And we were so concerned that it was really important to keep it going straight downwind, because if you went sideways at all on either side, you're going to broach, which means you'd go flat on your side.
And then the wave would come.
And the wave would come, and you'd be swamped.
Yep.
And that was not good. So we just kept going and going and going. And happily, it's a really big lake, long lake. And we ended up in the middle of the night about 3 o'clock. The winds went down to about 30 miles an hour, and it was pitch black. But we found a place, pulled in, and dropped anchor. And then the next day, apparently it brought out every black fly known to man in all of North Dakota. I was steering the boat. The daughter of the fellow who was with us, she was there with a fly swatter, just swatting. We got to the dock, and your mother was so mad at me that I had let us get into that situation. And we got down there, and she just was hardly speaking to me all the way back. We got to the dock and got off the boat, and she says, "I've never been so mad at you in my life." And then she gave me a hug, and she said, "Thank you for saving our lives." One of my favorite ones was we were coming back, I think it was over 4th of July. We were coming back, and it was a pretty stiff wind, probably 20 miles an hour or something like that. But going into the marina at Fort Stevenson, there's lots of angles, and mm-hmm. it's you got to really know what you're doing and do it and not make any mistakes. And so I was coming in, the engine had quit, and I called into the marina, and there were a lot of, it was 4th of July, so there were a lot of people down there, And I said, "This is Gypsy. Our engine's out." They said, "Do you want somebody to come out and give you a tow?" And I said, "No, I think I can do this." So we went flying back, and there were a lot of fishermen out there, and we went just flying by them all through the breakwater. It was exciting, and docks of boats on either side, and it was fairly narrow, and tacked again and went right down the middle, and we're moving pretty fast. And I saw all these skippers, all these sailors were all standing on the dock watching, ostensibly there to help us. So I got to where our slip was, and I turned, and it pointed right into the wind, and I stopped it on a dime. Everybody standing there, and they did help me tie down the boat, but then I noticed that all the skippers were passing money back and forth. I said, "What's going on?" They were all taking bets on whether we'd make it or not.
Why is it that mom stopped sailing until you brought a full-time engineer and a full-time doctor on board? She wasn't coming back again.
Well, her other reason was that she said the 40 years of sailing with the same man was enough for any woman.
That was the late Bill Butcher talking with his daughter Marnie Peel at the StoryCorps mobile recording booth last July during its month-long stay in Bismarck. Bill Butcher died Friday. A memorial service will be held at 5 p.m. Thursday at the Elks Lodge in Bismarck. His ashes will be spread on the waters of Lake Sakakawea. Coming up on Main Street, we'll have part one of a Harvest Public Media series on a research center for animal diseases. And we'll talk with North Dakota paleontologist Clint Boyd about a remarkable fossil discovery in the state. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. After seeing an ideal thaw and melt, Fargo city officials are watching what could be a 35-foot crest of the Red River.
35 feet is a very tolerable flood. We can handle that. But again, it could have been much higher. We're very pleased that it wasn't.
Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney says while the threat is diminishing, the Red River is expected to remain around the 35-foot level for much of this week. He says some diligence will be required.
Check all your decks, check your pumps, make sure everything's functioning. So it's more when people come to a crest, we just have to make sure everything continues to function. We're going to have a faster drop-off than we thought, so that's nice because then we won't be at risk as much as when it starts to fall back down.
While the threat of river flooding is subsiding in Fargo, some parts of rural Cass County are dealing with overland flooding. Cass County engineer Jason Benson says while the melt has been ideal, the compaction of snow in ditches and culverts is presenting problems.
But along the Cheyenne River north of West Fargo, where the Maple River water comes in and the Rush River, there's a lot of overland flooding all the way up through Argusville. And then as the Red River comes up, several of our county roads along the Red River are also starting to get overtopped.
Benson says one home northwest of Harwood was lost to flooding early this morning. He says emergency crews were called to deliver sandbags.
It sounded like a pump failed, and then some water ended up overtopping a corner of a small levee. around their home, and so we're getting sandbags in to button up some of those low areas for that person.
Benson says a number of county and township roads have been topped over by water. He says access could be an ongoing issue for many residents this week and possibly next. 4 years ago, the legislature authorized a pilot program for the Public Service Commission to begin inspecting railroad tracks and equipment. That followed a derailment of an oil train near Castleton. The legislature authorized the hiring of two inspectors. The pilot project is ending, and the PSC wants to continue it. Castleton Republican Senator Gary Lee helped to shepherd the original pilot project, and he hopes the legislature will continue.
Those guys are out walking track, walking train yards, visually inspecting things that have, in fact, my opinion again, is saved us train accidents and derailments by what they've been able to find and have repaired before the train was able to move. They've even stopped trains from moving out when they found deficiencies.
Lee says about 100 North Dakota communities have mainline rail running through the town.
We need to be pretty confident that when they're going down the track, that they're going to stay on the track.
Funding for the inspections comes from a tax railroads pay on the fuel they use. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Construction on the federal National Bio and Agro Defense Facility is behind schedule and over its initial costs by nearly $800 million. Known as NBAF, the facility in Manhattan, Kansas, will be the main research center for some nasty animal diseases. Harvest Public Media's Laura Ziegler offers the first in this series of reports on the progress and possible roadblocks moving forward.
Against the buzz of backhoes and bulldozers, a fortress of concrete and steel buildings is gradually taking shape on the Kansas State University campus. Once complete, the National Bio and Agri-Defense Facility, or NBAF, will be a top-level biocontainment laboratory. It's designed to study exotic animal diseases that are lethal to humans and wildly contagious among livestock. These germs are microscopic and often airborne. They're transmitted through contact with an infected person or as easily as a contaminated Kleenex released into a feedlot. NBAF was born out of a post-9/11 presidential directive designed to protect the U.S. food supply from an agro-terror attack. Dim Barr came on as Homeland Security Project Manager a couple years after Kansas was awarded the project in 2009. A native of McPherson, Kansas, and a K-State graduate, he can barely contain his excitement.
Interesting project, complex project, internationally significant project. Yeah, it's all fun.
Barr and contractors for the McCarthy-Mortensen joint venture have been working out of a bunch of trailers on the site's parking lot since government officials broke ground in 2013. He says watching the first shovel of ceremonial dirt get pitched was an emotional moment.
I mean, to have cabinet-level officials with the governor, Senator Moran, Senator Roberts, that's a nice recognition of all the hard work that everybody had done up to that time.
Barr still keeps a few of the ribbon-clad spades in a corner of his office. But it's been a bumpy road to this point. It didn't take long after Kansas won the project for the decision to be declared political. Then a 2010 congressionally mandated review of the lab's potential risk stunned local and scientific communities. Dr. Ronald Atlas chaired a committee evaluating risk at NBAF and spoke to reporters when the review came out.
The probability of an infection resulting from a laboratory release of foot and mouth disease from the NBAF in Manhattan, Kansas, approaches 70% over 50 years of operation, with a projected economic impact of $9 to $50 billion.
In response, Homeland Security fortified concrete walls and steel barriers. That and other extra measures drove up the price by millions, but were enough to reduce the risk of a disease release to less than 1%. The final report was controversial, but NBAF was a go. To ensure the project got finished, Kansas contributed more than $300 million. All of the $1.25 billion needed to complete the project is appropriated, but experts worry about the cost of maintaining these labs. It's astronomical. In fact, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is currently asking Congress for $400 million to replace a 14-year-old facility that studies Ebola and emerging flu strains. That facility was supposed to last 50 years. Dr. Marty Vanier, who's on contract with DHS, is part of a targeted effort to work with community groups and the press. She's confident NBAF will be on time and on budget.
We've got a team, not only the design team, but also folks that are part of the NBAF program office and project who have been thinking about those kinds of details and working on those details for years.
As it turns out, future funding won't even be Homeland Security's problem. President Trump has shifted operational authority for NBAF from Homeland Security to the Department of Agriculture once construction and certification are complete by 2022. Former Kansas Governor John Carlin, a Democrat who helped Kansas win the lab, is concerned the USDA has other priorities.
Crop insurance, food stamps always get the focus, and whether the operating money for NBAF would be a high enough priority that would always be funded, that remains to be seen.
Meanwhile, the Homeland Security budget eliminates long-term operational funding for NBAF and transfers it to USDA. Also, it boosts funding for border security and immigration enforcement. This raises the question as to whether agroterrorism is on the government's radar at all. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Laura Ziegler.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that focuses on America's farm and rural issues. Next on Main Street, North Dakota is making headlines with an event that happened 66 million years ago.
In 1836, a woman in New York was gruesomely murdered. Two newspapers describe the alleged murderer in very different ways.
They both looked at the same crime and had entirely different interpretations based on what they thought their readers would prefer to hear.
Sound familiar? The deep roots of fake news. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Clint Boyd. He is a senior paleontologist with the North Dakota Geological Survey, and that's managed by the North Dakota Industrial Commission. He joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Hello, Clint.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's get a little background on what a paleontologist does for the Industrial Commission. Describe your role in the state.
Well, what we do is we go out and identify fossils across the state of North Dakota, and then we also manage the North Dakota State Fossil Collection, where we store fossils that come from the state of North Dakota and use those for exhibits all across the state and to make sure that these fossils get saved for future generations of North Dakotans to be able to see and enjoy.
And how would you rate the state of North Dakota in terms of the fossil hunting world?
North Dakota is a very good state for fossil hunting. Unlike a lot of states where there's maybe one or two really good places you could go to and then the rest of the state doesn't really have anything, the entire surface of North Dakota can preserve fossils of one kind or another. So depending on where you go, you can find different types of fossils, but anywhere in North Dakota you can make a fossil discovery.
Well, let's talk about this discovery in the Hell Creek Formation in far southwest North Dakota, and I guess it goes into other states as well. This fellow by the name of Robert DePalma, he's a PhD candidate at the University of Kansas, has been picking around this site for several years. Could you describe for our listeners what it is he's claimed to have found?
To start off with, that whole southwest area of North Dakota has been pretty well known for quite a few decades as being one of the best areas to study the extinction of the dinosaurs, what's called the Cretaceous Paleogene or KPG extinction. So this has already been a great area for learning more about the end of the dinosaurs. And what they have at this site is the fauna, so a group of animals that were preserved right at the moment of that impact event that led to the death of the dinosaurs. So we've known that there are rocks there deposited from that impact for quite a while, but we've never had evidence of exactly what happened at that moment on that day. And so that's what they claim to have found at this site.
So 66 million years ago, an asteroid a few miles across crashes into the Earth around the Yucatan Peninsula and sends seismic waves all around the planet, including Hell Creek.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's a smack.
Yeah, and you know the estimated magnitude of that earthquake is somewhere between a 10 to an 11, you know, which is far larger than anything we've ever seen before in recorded human history. And so it's hard to even imagine what that earthquake would have been like.
And this particular formation that this paleontologist is picking through is evidence of that snapshot of that moment in time.
Yep. So, and as I'm sure everyone can appreciate, having an exact moment in time preserved in the fossil record is a very rare thing for any moment in time. You know, most of what we're looking at is kind of a bunch of stuff that's been mixed together over many years or even over many centuries and then gets deposited together finally in the end. So any site that preserves kind of a moment in time is always a special and very rare find. And then to be able to have a moment in time from an event as momentous as this extinction of the dinosaurs event is just kind of mind-blowing to be able to find that.
And what he found is actually literally evidence of just a pile of animals and plants and debris, right?
Right. So the whole Hell Creek Formation, which lasts for about a little over a million years before the extinction, is a big river valley. Think about the Mississippi River and all the little tributaries feeding into it and then all the floodplain around the Mississippi River. That's kind of the type of environment that you're looking at in the Hell Creek Formation. And so in most places when the impact hit, you either didn't preserve the material from the impact or where you did, it was mostly across that floodplain. So you get the impact material but not really any fossils with it. At this site, there's one of the main river channels is hypothesized to have been here based on looking at the sediments. And so this river had cut down lower than the surrounding mud plain. And that meant that when this event happened, there was space available to pile up material and preserve it in this area. And so it kind of makes the ideal place to have these specimens preserved.
And this is a mass extinction. And some of the things he's finding are specimens that have not been seen before, correct?
Yeah, so most of the animals, at least that have been reported on so far from the site, are different types of fish, fish like paddlefish and gar and bowfin, animals like that. And they're just exquisitely preserved, three-dimensional. You know, the sturgeon, as most people know, sturgeon have little bony plates in their skin, and the bony plates are still in place. A lot of the fish are buried with their mouths open and kind of interpreted that they were struggling to breathe when they were buried. So the preservation of these fish is just phenomenal. Normally in this formation, when we find fish, they're just little tiny bits, like maybe part of a backbone here, a little chunk of skull here. And so these beautiful three-dimensional fish themselves, even if it wasn't tied to this event, just the fossils at this site that have been reported on so far would be significant on their own.
So what was North Dakota like 66 million years ago before this asteroid hit?
So it's a very warm and humid time. If you want to think about the type of environment, it's very swampy, a lot of cypress trees, so very much like a southern Louisiana type area nowadays. So very unlike North Dakota in most days, as it is right now. And like I said, there are these big broad rivers that are winding through and depositing sediment in the rivers. And then every time they would flood, they're depositing muds and things like that up into the floodplains. So just very broad meandering area reaching towards an inland sea that extends from the Gulf of Mexico up all the way to the Arctic Ocean that covered the central part of the U.S.
And just as a reminder, this was at a time in the Earth's history when we didn't have sea ice, correct?
Right, yeah. We may have been starting to approach a time where we were maybe getting to get some sea ice, but through most of the Cretaceous, there's no sea ice going on. So sea level's much higher than it is today. Additionally, we're relatively early in the uprising of the Rocky Mountains as well. And so that's helping to push the whole western part of now the United States up and then draining all of the rock and water and everything over to the middle of the continent. And so that's where all the rock is coming from at this time, is from the Rocky Mountains flowing to that inland sea.
So just a reminder that the Earth can get pretty wet when the ice goes away.
Yep.
Right. Well, what did North Dakota look like after the asteroid strike?
So that's a good question. We know that the asteroid strike was pretty detrimental to the area. We were far enough away that it wasn't like the immediate destruction that you would have seen in the area around the impact site. But there was enough debris put into the atmosphere that it, at least for the period of a few days, if not for a few months, probably blacked out the sun And so you would have seen this shift of this very warm, humid environment suddenly cooling off quite a bit as that sun is blocked out. And then you'd have all of the bits of rock and debris raining back down through the atmosphere, potentially touching off wildfires in areas. And then because you'd have a loss of plant material over the next months to years, you'd see, you know, lower oxygen levels, very few plant material that's growing. And if there's no plants, then the plant-eating animals can't eat. If the plant-eating animals can't eat, the meat-eating animals can't eat. So the whole food chain collapses right there. And so, you know, we see afterwards in the rocks immediately above the impact what's called the fern spike. Ferns are very opportunistic, and if something very detrimental happens to an area, like, say, a really big wildfire, one of the first plants that comes back in are ferns until other more established plants grow up and then replace them. And right after this extinction event in the fossil record, we see this fern spike where there's just a massive growth of ferns across everything. We see very good evidence for earthworms and stuff like that kind of reworking and burrowing in this upper layer right above it. So there wasn't much left of what had been the ecosystem of the Hell Creek immediately afterwards.
Wow. So what would our place look like if this asteroid had never hit?
That's a good question. You know, there's been some argument about whether the dinosaurs were already going extinct and if this was just kind of the final thing that pushed them over the edge. But at the same time, more recent studies have suggested that that was maybe not the case. Maybe we were going to see certain groups of dinosaurs go extinct. But overall, dinosaurs as a group were doing fairly well. And so we probably wouldn't have the same type of dinosaurs that we see 65 million years ago, 66 million years ago around today, because they would have continued to change and evolve through time. But we would probably still see a very dinosaur-dominated ecosystem right now.
Well, there used to be, I think, a bit of a debate over whether it was all these volcanoes going off around the Earth that might have precipitated mass extinctions, or whether it was this asteroid or some combination of them. But there seems to be very conclusive evidence now of this massive asteroid strike.
I don't think anyone would debate anymore whether or not the asteroid impact happened. It clearly happened. It's clearly well-timed to happen about the time of the extinction of the dinosaurs. The question now is just, was it the sole factor? Or like I said, was there already other things like that volcanism that was going on that was kind of making the environment more difficult, was maybe making it so that they were kind of on the precipice and the asteroid strike was just enough to push it over the edge?
Now, I remember from years ago reading about this iridium, which showed evidence of the asteroid strike. But this paleontologist by the name of De Palma has also been finding, what are these little globs of glass called?
Spherules?
Yes.
And we've known about those for a while as well. The spherules are formed, so the asteroid hits the ground so hard, it punches through so much rock that the resulting explosion blows pieces of the surface of the Earth up into the atmosphere. And in fact, some of it, it's hypothesized, probably left the Earth and could be found, say, on the moon or elsewhere in the solar system. It hits so hard. But a lot of it doesn't reach quite enough of a velocity to leave Earth's orbit and then ends up coming back down again through the atmosphere. That process, of course, superheats the rock, you know, which is why we have heat shields on spaceships to help them get back down. And when the rock superheats, it all melts down and forms into little melted blobs of rock, kind of like glass, rains back down as it's falling down. Kind of the best shape to travel through the air is kind of a sphere shape. And then by the time it reaches the ground, you just have these little tiny, almost BB-sized pieces of glass rock that have rained back down on the surface again.
And that's evidence on the Hell Creek site. It's all over there, isn't it?
Yeah. Normally, though, you only see that in that KT boundary layer, in the lower portion of the KT boundary layer, as the first piece of evidence that the impact has happened. And then on top of that, you'll get kind of the more distinctive ash layer with the iridium and things like that. What they have at this site is the whole about 4 feet worth of rock that has those really well-preserved fish fossils and that records that seismic activity right after the impact. Those spherules are all throughout those 4 feet, and then you get the finer fallout right at the top, forming that KT boundary layer, KPG boundary layer. That's how they're helping tie this to the impact event, is the fact that The spherules aren't just contained to a layer above this boundary. They're all mixed throughout that 4 feet of rock. And that had to have happened. They calculate the first spherules would have started to fall out in North Dakota about 13 to 15 minutes after the impact. And then about 2 hours after the impact is when you would start getting the dust layer coming down. So this 4 foot of rock had to be deposited between about 15 minutes and 2 hours after the impact event.
I was reading the New Yorker story, which was just published a couple of weeks ago, about this De Palma, and he's quoted in there as saying about this discovery, it's like finding the Holy Grail clutched in the bony fingers of Jimmy Hoffa sitting on top of the Lost Ark. So is this a safe place? Is North Dakota secure from fossil poaching or, you know, somebody kind of trying to crawl over this thing and maybe do some damage to real research?
Well, I think that's definitely a concern. And, you know, in that article, you read a lot about how they protected the identity of the site, the location of the site, and didn't really talk about it much until they got this study done. And part of the reason for that is the concern about poaching. We do see relatively regularly out in the Hell Creek Formation areas where people have been digging and removing material where they're not supposed to, both on private land and on public lands. So in part, those concerns are justified. But in order to publish on these areas, you know, when you publish on it, you have to say where it comes from. Otherwise, there's no way for anyone to follow up and confirm that what you're saying is correct. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of one of the risks that we take. But I've already been talking with land managers for agencies like the Bureau of Land Management, which has some nearby property, about what we should be doing now, you know, over the next few months to next couple years, because we expect then to see an increased interest in this area of people coming out and looking for stuff, what we can do to make sure that anyone who's coming out is doing everything within the proper regulations and within the law, and so that we don't lose sites like this to any type of poaching.
Should North Dakota be making more of this? I mean, we're talking about a Teddy Roosevelt Museum and Library, and of course he spent a few years here. This stuff's been here for 66 million years, and it's getting a lot of attention in the scientific community.
Well, I think it's, you know, North Dakota, like I mentioned earlier, North Dakota was already a great center for studying this extinction event to begin with. And then you add this site to it, and it really just elevates us right up to the top of areas to study the extinction of the dinosaurs. I think that it would be a great idea if we could have, you know, a place that we could set aside and preserve, you know, something like a state park or something like that, where we could have active research going on, but then also have public tours where people could come out and actually see what this event looked like. You know, anything like that, though, would be entirely dependent upon working with, you know, various landowners mm-hmm. where these sites are located, if they were interested in having something like that set up, you know, and then, of course, going through all the legal hoops to get something like that designated. But there are programs in North Dakota that would make that possible. We have in the past worked mostly through the North Dakota Parks and Rec Department to have fossil sites that are on private land designated as natural areas, which helps give them some increased protection. And then over time, we've seen at least one of these sites, then the landowner, upon their passing, will to the state to be protected for future generations. So there's a pathway there. It would just depend on what the landowners were open to.
Well, in the meantime, he's finding all these fish. He's found what might be feathers from a dinosaur and a fossilized egg with an embryo inside of it. So lots of exciting stuff to talk about for lay people like me, at any rate. Thank you for shedding some light on this. Clint Boyd is the senior paleontologist with the North Dakota Geological Survey.
Thank you.
The Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 8th. Tomorrow will be the birthday of Calvin Andrist, who was born in Ada, Minnesota in 1887. His son John said, "Dad always claimed two birth dates." After celebrating on April 10th for half a century, he had reason to request an official birth certificate that showed his birth as April 9th. He refused to give up April 10th and declared henceforth and forevermore he would have a two-day birthday celebration. When still a youngster, Calvin's family moved to a Canadian homestead north of Crosby. But his stepmother wasn't fond of him, so he set out on foot at age 16 to make his fortune in the town of Portal, some 25 miles away. With only an eighth-grade education, his career choices were limited, but farm work was plentiful. However, when fall came, there was little to sustain him. So he prepared to distribute Canadian booze in the dry state of North Dakota. But in the fall of 1907, fate intervened when a newspaper publisher offered Andrist a job. The publisher promised room and board to tide him over until farm work resumed in the spring. But instead, Andrist found work with another paper in Larson, North Dakota. When that building was destroyed by fire, he moved on to the Ambrose Newsman newspaper. And in 1912, he got the chance to run his own paper when a group of merchants in Noonan bought out the Noonan Miner. They offered the business to Cal, virtually for nothing. He later purchased the Divide County Journal in Crosby. Calvin Andrist went on to become president of the North Dakota Press Association and was inducted into the North Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame in 1978. Meanwhile, son John began working for Calvin in 1950. After Calvin retired, John took over. John shortened the paper's name to The Journal in the 1970s because the paper's territory now extended beyond the boundaries of Divide County. John had attended his first North Dakota Newspaper Association meeting in 1947 while still in high school, and he took a spot on the national scene when he served as president of the National Newspaper Association. Like his father, he was inducted into the North Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame. That brings us to John's son, Steve, the third generation of Andrists. During the 1980s, Steve worked for the Bismarck Tribune and then for papers in Winona and Rochester, Minnesota. In 1991, he went back to Crosby to take over his family legacy at the Journal. Today, continuing the family tradition of leadership, Steve Andrist serves as the executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
Tuesday on Main Street, the International Music Camp is gearing up for another big summer. The camp is located at the International Peace Garden on the border of North Dakota and Manitoba. And tomorrow we'll get a preview from co-directors Tim and Christine Bauman. A little hint here, more than music happens there. And it's maple syrup season. This weekend you can get hands-on experience at Fort Stevenson State Park. We'll talk about Maple Sugaring Day with park manager Chad Troutman. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.